Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Welcome back to America This Week, a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. I'm Father Patty Gilger, and I'm joined by Robert David Sullivan and by Ashley McKinless. So we're speaking a little bit about, the news and the views from the Catholic world this week here at America This Week. And we've just talked a little bit about this movie, Eighth Grade, where we talk about modes of self-formation. We have another piece where we're talking about self-formation that's written by Professor Holly Taylor Kuhlman of Rhode Island University. Her piece is titled, 50 Years After Humanae Vitae, We Still Buy Into the Myth of the Self-Made Man. And Holly joins us here. Welcome to the show, Holly.
Thank you so much.
Really grateful that you could be here with us all the way from Rhode Island.
Yeah, just a quick correction. It's Providence College in Rhode Island.
Ah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. That's what I meant to say. I had all that prepared.
No problem.
Thank you. Providence College in Rhode Island. Yeah. And Holly, can you, this is the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae. Can you give us a little bit of a baseline for listeners who may not be quite as well versed in what that is or what it means about where this comes from?
Right. I think we're here on the very day of the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae, mm-hmm. if I'm correct about that. So Humanae Vitae, an encyclical published that the most immediate thing to say is that it was an encyclical published and plunged almost immediately. In fact, even in a certain sense prior to its publication, into pitched controversy.
Hmm.
Just a couple of the facts. Written by Pope Paul VI, 1968. And it deals with, as I mentioned in the essay that I wrote for America,
mm-hmm.
it certainly what has been most controversial is its fundamental teaching against artificial birth control.
Yeah.
But my sense of the document is that there are some really interesting, more fundamental claims. Certainly the encyclical offers those claims as arguments toward that concrete conclusion. But the claims are more important, in the end. They affect a wide variety of different concrete practices and scenarios. And so I just thought I would take a step back for a moment.
What are those claims?
Right.
What's the vision that it sets forth?
Right. Well, maybe I should rephrase it this way. I would say that the encyclical asks some questions of us and mm-hmm. challenges us in ways that push us even more than they did 50 years ago to try to look for answers. So the concerns that it names are concerns with our interest in controlling ourselves.
Yeah.
Now listen, I'm a parent of four children, so I have said control yourself.
Hopefully frequently.
But, and this is not disconnected from the conversation that you were just having about social media.
Oh.
I think we've moved almost imperceptibly to a place where control of ourselves is something that is woven into our life and our experience in a way that really is, in my view, new.
Mm.
And I don't intend to just issue Jeremiad and just talk about doomsday, but I do think there are some really troubling aspects to that constant, unrelenting pressure to I'll just say it a little bit provocatively, to compose yourself in certain ways and then offer yourself to the world.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm saying you don't necessarily mean compose as in restrain yourself, but compose as in creating yourself or creating an identity.
Maybe I should use the theological term, to create yourself. I'm thinking now of social media because you all were just speaking about it. To create yourself for the consumption.
That's right.
Of other people.
Before we jump to the implications for today, could you talk a little about the context out of which this was coming? What were the problems it was responding to back in 1968?
Right. Well, I think, again, you could answer that question both immediately and then more broadly. Certainly, the encyclical followed upon the work of a commission originally created by John the 23rd prior to Paul VI. And the commission was clear that part of what it wanted to examine was the question of what was a new technology at that moment, artificial contraception, and to try to render some judgment. Part of what made the encyclical so controversial was that the commission, made up of a number of different members and including some lay members, came to a different conclusion than the encyclical that Paul VI issued. In other words, it was more open to the possibility of artificial contraception. So there's that specific question. That's mm-hmm. why I say controversy from the very moment, in fact, prior to the moment.
Can you remind our audience here, Holly, what decision did Paul VI make after the recommendation was given?
Right. So his view was, and clearly stated in the encyclical, is that it is not possible to licitly use artificial contraception, that what artificial contraception does is to divide mm-hmm. marital intimacy from one of its crucial purposes, which is procreation.
Excellent.
And that those two would have to remain joined. Classically, the argument goes that intimacy in marriage is designed both for greater unity between the two spouses and also for procreation, for the both birthing and raising of children too. That whole kind of that whole project
yeah.
Of openness to that project of family, and that dividing it really distorts the act itself. You know, if I could just say very quickly, when I'm talking to my own students about this, for whom many of whom, you know, it's a bizarre view.
Right.
They obviously have never inhabited a world in which they've always inhabited a world in which artificial contraception was the norm.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a funny analogy that could be made here, just very briefly. The claim of Humanae Vitae, and then the traditional claim of the church, is that procreation goes together with intimacy in an analogous way that perhaps we could say nutrition and eating.
Okay.
So if you want to go on a diet, if we were going to follow the analogous reasoning, it would be you have to eat in ways that support that goal, but you shouldn't attach some weird machine to your body that grabs the food and empties it out of your stomach.
I see.
So you need to work with the human body in pursuing that goal. As many of us are trying to do, lose a little weight. I think there's something there. It's not a perfect analogy by any stretch, but it's something that can kind of make sense to people.
You mentioned that the most controversial part of this was the stance on birth control, but you don't really focus too much on that in your piece. You look kind of more broadly about what the implications of that are, and you talk about the myth of the self-made man. What does Humanae Vitae tell us about this myth of self-creation that seems so common, not even like in terms of economics? We talk about people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, or you talk about even in autobiography, this idea that we create this ideal image of ourselves as traveling and interesting. Why do you want to push back against that myth?
Right, exactly. I think it's in part, you know, I mentioned in the piece that I do intentionally refer to gender there. My own experience as a woman is that the myth doesn't seem to work as well in practical day-to-day life for women as it does for men. And it partly comes out of my work in theology, but it partly comes out of my own life and experience, that it's just very clear to me that I am, in fact, not self-made in a million different ways, and that I need ways to think about that. I need ways to expand my own imagination and equip myself for other narratives, for other what for me are more fruitful and life-giving ways to think about what I'm up to. And in a certain sense, I would say I think that's the gift that Humanae Vitae gives. It prompts us to say, to interrogate, that, to question that claim a little bit, that the truest and noblest and most real of everything is that which we produce ourselves. And, you know, I mentioned a couple different resources that I myself have found to be helpful in this regard. As a student of literature in my undergraduate days, I really loved the work of author Charles Williams. He has this very interesting phrase of preferring the given. I think it's possible to misunderstand that phrase as just giving in, accepting whatever comes your way. I don't think that's what he meant by that. But it does push back and say, we don't start with a blank slate. We start in this profoundly communally rooted reality. And then in that, you know, the world of that given, or again, if you're going to say it more theologically, we might say in the reality of the createdness that we already live in, then we take steps to look carefully, to restore what needs to be restored, to remove what needs to be removed. In a way, what I'm saying is very simple. But like I said, my sense is that in several different venues, widely differing, sometimes cultural venues, we have to remind ourselves to think in that way and to feel good about that, to recognize that that's a good way forward.
What would you say are the dangers of buying into the myth of a self-made man who gets hurt or left behind in that narrative?
Right, exactly. So I think two groups, other people and us.
That seems to include everybody.
You know, in a sense, I think it's the person that maybe fully buys into that myth in the most extreme way falls into the pathology of narcissism. You know, and that is a person who can do a great deal of damage to the people around them. Especially, I'm going to go back to a favorite theme of Pope Francis, the theme of mercy. Mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult to be a merciful person when you imagine that you are a person who has operated without the benefit of mercy.
Yeah, that's right. Instead of saying, I've made it, why can't everyone else?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. But then I'll just say briefly, I think also the more that we live in a castle of our own making, the more that we become lonely and isolated and so on. In fact, as I said, I think many, many different cultural dynamics could be connected to this topic. And in the end, I didn't mention in the essay row, but in the end, I think there are important connections to the opioid crisis that we see now. What we see is people who are lonely and sad and in pain. And I say, obviously, it's a very big issue to discuss, but I think there are ways in which this myth, the self-made person, leaves people, yeah, not merciful to themselves either in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Is it almost like people feel shameful that they have interdependence with other people, and it's almost like instead of celebrating that we have these connections, it's almost like they're made to feel less successful because they show mercy to other people, they put other people's needs not necessarily first, but they take them into account. Is that
precisely? I would say both, you know, the way that we feel about it. So I could even, you know, I've referred briefly to my own experience. I wouldn't mind saying for myself, as a woman doing the work of theology, for example, I've become aware that I often work best in situations of conversation and dialogue and intentionally and explicitly communal scenarios, even though that is not always the norm. So there are two dangers for me. One would be to feel bad about myself because I'm not doing it in this thoroughly isolated, self-made way that I'm supposed to do it. But then also beyond the way I feel about it is the way that I act and all of us act. You know, we don't tend to foster the habits that go in a different direction.
Yeah, you do such a good job. I really enjoyed this piece a lot, Holly. I just want to say to you, and you're totally welcome. And one of the, like, this dialectic or this, you know, dyad that you're drawing, I feel like we have all of these words that kind of go, you're either one thing or another thing. So for example, you know, control is right at the heart of that. You're either in control or you're being controlled, or you're the actor or you're passive and you're being manipulated by someone else. And it seems like we've constructed this kind of self-understanding of a community and of ourselves as individuals where there's no middle ground to be had there. And then you give us that really interesting phrase, you know, that we talk about preferring the given, or that you also quote, of course, I'm going to love any article where you quote J.R.R. Tolkien in it, this idea of sub-creation, not original creation, sub-creation. Anything that you'd want to say about where this points us? What kind of person are we becoming?
Right. I think you have really put your finger on something very important there in the drive for a kind of sharp dichotomy. And it is exactly, you know, against which I'm trying to press a little bit. Mm. So for me, for example, you know, we could get very philosophical, but I think of categories like conversation, I actually think, is a deeply rich category. Friendship, mutuality, interconnection. And then the word that was coming to mind that I think of as a more philosophical term was participation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not always a matter of competition, a matter of a zero-sum game, where somebody wins. So there are other ways to conceptualize what we're up to here. And, of course, sub-creation inherently does that. It says I'm swimming in a world that is given to me. In a certain way, I'm swimming in what is already gift. Now, what do I do going forward?
One of the, like, and you talk about this idea of participation or of collaboration or of conversation, and you give this beautiful example at the end of your piece. And I was thinking, in addition to those examples, I was thinking of motherhood, you know, or pregnancy or something where, you know, literally my own life, like, you know, immersed in the body of my mother, that I'm obviously not self-sufficient in this. You give this great example of St. Augustine of Hippo and his mother, an experience that they share. Can you say something real brief about that? We only have about 90 seconds left to talk, but I wanted to be sure to point this out.
Right. So I just cite briefly a crucial passage in Augustine's Confessions. He describes a certain kind of vision. It's a little mysterious, but and something that what he and his mother share.
Yeah.
It's not an individual vision.
That's right.
And it's a little hard to make out, but it ends in a kind of way that they are able to hear something that is not usually audible. And this is what they hear as they listen to all things created. They begin to hear those things saying, we have not made ourselves. And I would agree with you. I think there's nothing accidental there about that crucial intimate relationship between a mother and a son. And I think that really signals for us much broader realities. We are related to one another, whether we recognize it or not. And that when we do recognize it, we're able to go forward better.
Well, Holly, this has been a really fantastic conversation. I wish we had more time to visit with you, but this has been really wonderful. Thank you for joining us here.
Thank you so much.
Holly Taylor Kuhlman, who just joined us, is an assistant professor of theology at Providence College in Rhode Island. Her piece called 50 Years After Humana Vitae, We Still Buy Into the Myth of the Self-Made Man, you can find at americamagazine.org/serious, as you can find all the rest of our pieces there today. I really found this conversation fascinating.
I do too, and it has a lot of applications for what we were talking about earlier in terms of political leadership, which she also gets into in her piece.
This has been really a fantastic conversation between the three of us. I'm really pleased to be with you. For Ashley McKinless, and on behalf of Robert David Sullivan, my name is Father Patty Gilger. You have been listening to America This Week on Sirius 129, the Catholic Channel. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.